natürlich, ja. Ja, das ist das Tibetische und das ist das Englische. Ja.
So, good afternoon, everybody. It's my very great pleasure to introduce a former teacher of mine from Hamburg University, Dr. Klaus-Dieter Matthes. It's actually the first time that the Shedra East has invited a Western scholar to give a talk here. So I would like to take a few minutes to say something about him and about his work. So whilst Klaus-Dieter Matthes was studying mathematics and physics, he took a trip to Asia where he became inspired to study Tibetan Buddhism. He was interested in...
That was a long time ago.
I'm starting at the beginning. He was interested in quantum mechanics, but in order to explain certain findings, he looked to Buddhist philosophy for deeper answers. And he therefore focused on the subjects of Abhidharma, Yogacara, and Madhyamaka. In the mid-80s, he was ordained as a novice Kagyupa monk by Kalu Rinpoche. He began his studies in Tibetology in Bonn, and at the same time, he studied Buddhist philosophy at the Kamalashila Institute, where he was soon able to translate for visiting lamas after having been trained by Kenpo Dzogchen Gyamso Rinpoche in Nepal. For his master's thesis on the Dharma Dharmata Vibhaga, another one of the five works by Maitreya / Asanga, he again collaborated with Kenpo Dzogchen Gyamso Rinpoche. But realizing he needed to be able to read Buddhist texts in the original Indian version, Dr. Matthes also began studying Indology and learned Sanskrit. At the beginning of the 90s, he obtained a PhD by working on Vasubandhu's commentary on the Dharma Dharmata Vibhaga. In 1993, he was appointed as the local director in Kathmandu of the Nepal-German Manuscript Preservation Project. And the purpose of this project is to retrieve manuscripts from the Himalaya region and preserve them for future generations by microfilm. And he did this for almost 8 years. And during that time, he also became interested in the Jonangpa school and its interpretations of the Tathagatagarbha teachings. And Wisdom Books recently published his work on Gerlutsawa Shenupel's commentary on the Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya, a text he had discovered during his activities for the Nepal-German Manuscript Preservation Project. And this led him to a new field of interest, the Sutra form of Mahamudra. And this is, by the way, that book that you cannot buy at ZAM, but in Kathmandu. ZAM is a big bus Buchladen. So in 1999, he helped establish a postgraduate course in Buddhist studies at the University of Kathmandu. And then he then taught Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Buddhist philosophy for some years at the universities of Vienna and Hamburg, where he replaced Professor David Jackson. He's especially interested in the Jonangpa and Kagyu schools, but also in the Nyingma and Sakya schools. And in terms of philosophical positions, Madhyamaka and Yogacara are his main subjects. Hope this is right so far.
Yeah, you said much too much.
Wait a second. It's soon over. So, Mr. Matthes now generally works at Hamburg University as a Tibetologist, although he has been teaching the last months at the Rangjung Yeshe Shedra, giving courses on Sutra Mahamudra and on the Gyulama in Sanskrit. And to conclude this slightly German introduction, I would like to mention a personal experience I had with Mr. Matthes. At the beginning of my own Buddhist studies at Hamburg University, me and my fellow students were attending his classes, and throughout the lesson, he would not stop mentioning the names of Buddhist figures and texts. And so by the end of the lesson, often our minds were blown away, but in hindsight, it is thanks to him that I was introduced to these teachers and texts, and of course, I'm grateful for that. So if some of you can relate to this feeling of being overwhelmed, don't give up. It will pay off.
Well, I hope I don't repeat this mistake here.
Anyway,
thank you very much for your very nice words and your introduction.
So please.
You told me that some of you were wondering why we scholars use the term Ratnagotra Vibhaga, whereas the Tibetans prefer Gyulama or Uttara Tantra. So... there's a very simple explanation for it. Buddhist titles consists mainly of two parts, the main title and then an ornamental title. And the main title would be Ratnagotra Vibhaga, and the ornamental title would be Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra. So the Tibetans simply have chosen Uttara Tantra from Mahayana Uttara Tantra, and Uttara Tantra is Tibetan. The Tibetan translation of Uttara Tantra is Gulama. So that's why, you know, like, but in late Indian texts, like the Sahakara Siddhi by Jnanasri Mitra, we find also Uttara Tantra. Yeah? So the work is referred to in Indian texts already by the word Uttara Tantra. But, well, I also, when I, before I started writing my book, I thought whether I should use the word Uttara Tantra, but there is a problem because there is a commentary on it by Asanga, and it is called Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya. Vyakya means commentary. So, if I used Uttara Tantra for the root text and Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya for the commentary, then people get confused and maybe they don't know that this is a commentary on the Uttara Tantra. So I finally decided to use the main title Ratnagotra Vibhaga. Yeah, also because I was a little bit afraid of our German Indologists. Maybe I don't know. So maybe I just explain you the meaning of the title. Vibhaga means analysis, yeah, and Ratnagotra is the jewel family, and it refers to the family of Buddhists, yeah, of all those who have a Buddha nature, which is all sentient beings, and they all have this potential to become a Buddha, or they are already a Buddha without knowing it, depending on which system you follow. And so all sentient beings belong to this jewel family, and the text is an analysis of this jewel family. So it's an analysis of Buddha nature, if you want. Then I was requested to say something about research on the Ratnagotra Vibhaga and the structure of the text. So I don't know whether you have studied the Gulama, or are you all familiar with the content of the work or not? I mean, because then I don't have to say so much about it. I mean, you all know what Buddha nature is, isn't it? I mean, well, I will divide my talk into three parts. First, I will say something on the structure of the text itself. Yeah. Then, about how it was interpreted. Yeah. In India, and then I will say something about Gulotsava's commentary on the Uttara Tantra or the Gulama. And Gulotsava was very much inclined to the Kakyu tradition, and he endorsed a so-called Sutra Mahamudra, which is a Mahamudra practice outside of the strict tantric context. In other words, a Mahamudra meditation which does not require formal tantric empowerment and generation and completion phase and so on. And this was very much contested. Sakya Pandita criticized this approach, and so later Kagyu scholars tried to defend the Sutra Mahamudra tradition. And this is also what Gulotsava did in his commentary. And he used the Gulama to show that you can give Mahamudra teachings on the basis of the non-tantric texts, like the Gulama or the Maitreya works or the Lankavatara Sutra and so on. So we will start now with an analysis of the structure of the text. Well, those among you who have studied the Gulama already know that it consists of a root text, yeah, which is commented upon by Asanga. But when you look at the root text itself, you find some verses which are followed by a commentary. So the root text itself has some verses which are already a commentary. So when you look at the beginning of the first chapter, you have like one long verse in praise of the Buddha, and then one long verse in praise of Dharma, and then one verse in praise of the Sangha. And they are verse number 4, 9, and 13. And they all have the same meter, yeah, in Sanskrit. And, well, we think that these three verses were the beginning of the original Ratnakotra Vibhaga. And that, like, verses 5 to 8, and then 10 to 12, and the verses after 13 are later insertions, yeah, which command these first three verses. So you can continue this analysis, and it would go too far now to show you all the details. I just mentioned an example, but it is evident that a group of verses constituted the original text, Ratnakotra Vibhaga, and that this text was eventually further extended by adding like commenting verses or other parts. Yeah. So that what we have now as Diggyulama consists of different layers of texts. And still, I have the impression that the final author or redactor composed a Gyulama commentary which is consistent and which is, in my opinion, a combination of the original Tathagatagarbha sutras, the sutras which teach a Buddha nature, and Yogacara philosophy. Yeah. But I will tell you more about that. Yeah. In other words, the Gyulama consists of old parts which are mainly based on a group of sutras, yeah, which define Buddha nature in a way that some Buddhist philosophers might not agree. Yeah. In a sense that Buddha nature has already all qualities, yeah, that Buddha nature is exactly the same as the Dharmakaya, yeah, that the Dharmakaya has an Atman, has a self, yeah, is permanent, is pure, yeah, and is blissful. And these attributes are a little bit strange, you know, for a Buddhist sutra, but still you have these attributes. You find these attributes in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, you find it in the Srimala Devi Sutra, and this attribution of Atman, of a personal self or a self, yeah, an ultimate self, is, so to say, a Buddhist term. Yeah. But then you all know that Buddhist philosophy always stresses the point that there is no Atman. There is no soul, there is no ultimate or perfect Atman or self. Yeah. So the whole intention of Buddhist philosophy is to refute the notion of a self. Yeah. The clinging to a self, to an Atman, is defined as the root of suffering and rebirth in samsara. Yeah. So the final version of the Gyulama somehow quotes and explains the doctrine of these old sutras, the Buddha Nature Sutras, but at the same time they try to give an explanation. Yeah? They try to establish a subtle difference between a Buddha Nature on the one hand and the Dharmakaya on the other hand, in the sense that, there is some kind of development. So something is in a sense growing or produced, yeah. And they try to explain away the concept of Atman, yeah, by saying, well, Atman was only taught in a particular context, and it refers to the absence of Atman. Yeah, the, and well, maybe let me say a little bit more about this problem of the Atman. It's quite important. You find in the Srimala Devi Sutra, maybe I just quote it from what I have written now. Yeah, the the following passage. That's now the Srimala Devi Sutra, it's not the Gulama. Yeah. Buddha, people misunderstand the five skandhas. They take the impermanent to be permanent, suffering to be bliss, the selfless as a self, and the impure to be pure. Even all Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas misunderstand the Dharmakaya of the Buddha, which is the experiential sphere of omniscient wisdom, and which has not been seen before by their wisdom of emptiness. Yeah. So we have here, first of all, the notion that sentient beings mistake well, the impermanence of samsara to be something permanent. Well, they see a self where there is no self. They experience suffering, but they misunderstand it as bliss. They think it is blissful. They are in the middle of impurity, but they perceive purity. So these are the four mistaken views, and they are traditionally taken as the cause for suffering or the cause of samsara. So the main Buddhist teaching is then to explain people, look, you know, there is no self, there is no permanent self, everything is impermanent. Or look, this is not bliss, this is suffering. Yeah? This is not purity, this is impure. And this is not permanent, there is nothing permanent, everything is impermanent. But then, as the sutra continues, you may mistakenly also say that the Dharmakaya of the Buddha is impermanent and, well, without a self and impure and so on. And this would be a mistake. Yeah. Well, this first set of teaching is correct. Yeah. And is necessary for people in samsara. But when you advance on the path and you have a direct experience of the Buddha nature or the Dharmakaya, then you need a new set of teaching, because you should not apply this notion of impermanence and selflessness and impurity to the Dharmakaya. That would be a mistake. Yeah. And that's why the Buddha taught the Dharmakaya has a self, yeah, or has the perfect self. It is permanent, it is pure, it is blissful. Yeah. So in other words, this attribution was given in a context. Yeah. It has to be understood as a remedy. Yeah. Against a first remedy, so to say. Yeah. So when you cling too strong to the notion of non-self and so on, this becomes an obstacle when you realize the true nature of mind, and that's why you need this additional teaching of the third Dhammacakra. So this is the sutra. It's very straightforward. It simply says, well, the Dharmakaya has a self. Yeah. And now in the the Gulama is now quoting this part, yeah, of the Srimala Devi Sutra, but now explains the following thing. I just give you an example. Yeah? The others, the heretics, perceive a self in the five skandhas, which are a basis for clinging to existence and thus enjoying clinging to an unreal self. Opposed to that, the realization of the perfect supreme self through a meditation which is based on the perfection of wisdom should be seen as the fruit. All the others, the heretics, agree that things such as forms which lack an own being have a self. This thing, as it is taken by them, namely as having the defining characteristic of a self, is false and therefore without a self at any time. The Buddha, however, has attained through his genuine wisdom the highest perfection, realizing the lack of a self in all phenomena. This lack of a self, as seen by him, namely as having the defining characteristic of a non-self, is not false. Therefore, this attainment is taken as a self in the sense that this self is nothing but the lack of a self. So in other words, the Gulama tries to explain away this notion of a self. First of all, it says, well, it is different from the Atman of the heretics. And then it is only the non-self, the lack of self, dakmi or nairatmya in Sanskrit, which is called self. And given the context that you need a remedy against clinging to the first remedy, you could argue that here the Gulama is not really maintaining a true self as the heretics do or the non-Buddhists do, but that this is simply another name for emptiness or for non-self. And in a similar way, it is this is also explained in terms of permanence and so on for the other perfections. Now it is quite interesting how Gulotsava explains that. Well, he says the true nature of mind is basically its emptiness. And our mind exists throughout beginningless time, and it will continue to exist, well, if not in samsara, then as an enlightened Buddha, who will remain in samsara as long as all sentient beings are liberated. So there is no beginning and no end to this continuum. And this continuum is empty. There is an emptiness of this continuum. And this emptiness will never change. It is not fabricated by anything. It is naturally there. And it does not depend on any causes and conditions. And it is like space. Space is not fabricated, and it does not depend on exterior causes and conditions. It just continues in its own sphere. And then Gulotsava says, well, this is what is called Atman. That this emptiness or this true nature of the mind has not been fabricated and does not depend on other or exterior causes and conditions. This is what we call Atman. And it's quite interesting when you look at the Prasanapada, Chandrakirti's commentary on the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas in the 15th chapter, you find that, anything which has not been fabricated and what does not depend on causes and conditions would be a svabhava, would be an own being, would be an inherent being, being in itself. So it is quite interesting that, even in the commentary by Chandrakirti, you find the term own being or inherent existence. Well, it is defined as the absence of own being, but still you find this term there. And in a similar way, we find Atman here explained as being nothing else as the absence of an Atman. Now, we find one more interesting attempt to explain away, a possible misunderstanding of the Tathagatagarbha sutras. In verse 127, three reasons are given why all sentient beings have a Buddha nature. It says, by virtue of the presence of Buddha wisdom in all kinds of sentient beings, That's reason number one, which means that the Buddha wisdom or the Dharmakaya pervades everything, and it also pervades all mind streams of sentient beings. Second, the fact that its stainlessness is by nature without duality, yeah, which means the non-duality or the emptiness or the suchness of my mind is not different from the emptiness or non-duality of a Buddha's mind. So in this sense, I have something in common, or we have something in common with the Buddha. Yeah. So that's reason number two. And reason number three is, and the fact that the Buddha nature's fruit has been metaphorically applied to the Buddha potential. And that's quite interesting, yeah, because this sentence implies that we use the word Buddha nature only in a metaphorical sense. Yeah. So we use the term for the fruit, yeah, and apply it to the cause, which is the potential. Yeah. And which means there must be a difference then, yeah, between the cause and the fruit. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense to say that, well, the fruit has been metaphorically applied to the cause. Yeah. And, well, that's a very strong argument Gulotsava is using again and again. Yeah. And to show that there is a subtle difference between Buddha nature and the Dharmakaya, the fully manifest Dharmakaya. Now, if the Buddha nature was completely identical with the Dharmakaya, and if it were really permanent, yeah, then it would be really the same as a non-Buddhist Atman. Yeah. Then it would, well, you could argue that this kind of interpretation of the Gulama would not be different anymore from the Advaita Vedanta, yeah, which is a non-Buddhist system, and which otherwise would explain everything exactly as the Gulama. So if you want to draw a line, you know, between Advaita Vedanta and the third turning of the Dhammacakra in Buddhism, well, this is what you have to do. I mean, you have to read the Gulama carefully and pay attention to such phrases which show a difference, yeah, between the Buddha nature and the Dharmakaya, or which explain Atman in a way that it is another term for Nairatmya, for absence of Atma. Now, I just give you one more example. Well, you have in a sutra, it's called the Anunatva Apurnatva Nyadesha, which is a terrible word, and it means teaching that the ultimate does not increase and that it does not decrease, that it does not diminish and it does not expand. In other words, the ultimate always remains the same. And in this sutra, which is quoted quite often in the Gulama, it is said, Shariputra, ultimate is an expression for the Buddha element in sentient beings. I'm not so comfortable with the translation element. It is kam or dhatu in Sanskrit. And it is compared to a jewel mine. It is a source. Yeah, from which you get all the jewels, yeah, of Buddha qualities. So it is a very nice example, because this shows that there are already some jewels, but they have to be retrieved from their adventitious stains, from the dirt and so on. They have to be polished. So anyway, we have this term Buddha element, or one could also say the source of Buddha qualities. Yeah. And this Buddha element in sentient beings, Shariputra, is an expression for the Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature, Shariputra, is an expression for the Dharmakaya. So again, we have here this full equation of Buddha nature with the Dharmakaya. Yeah, and to make clear that this is really intended by the sutra, we have an explanation in this sutra of the Dharmakaya in three states. Yeah? This sutra explains the Dharmakaya in sentient beings, the Dharmakaya in bodhisattvas, and the Dharmakaya of Buddhas. And it says, Shariputra, when this Dharmakaya is covered by the limitless defilements, carried away by samsara and moving from death to birth in the realms of samsara, which is without beginning or end, it is called source of Buddha qualities in sentient beings or Buddha nature. So this is quite remarkable. This sutra says, well, the Dharmakaya can be covered by adventitious stains, and then it is carried away by the suffering of samsara, and so on. Shariputra, when this same Dharmakaya has become averse to the suffering in the stream of samsara, when it is not excited about the objects of desire, when it is engaged in the conduct of enlightenment, so the 84,000 dharmas, which are contained in the 10 perfections, it is called bodhisattva. And then, Shariputra, when this same Dharmakaya, and this is quite important here, precisely this Dharmakaya, which has been covered before, yeah, by adventitious stains, when it is free from the stains of all the secondary defilements, when it is pure, very pure, and so on, then it is a Buddha. Yeah? So it is clear that this sutra fully equates the Buddha nature of suffering sentient beings, yeah, with the Dharmakaya of a fully enlightened Buddha. And now it is quite interesting what the Gulama is doing with that. Yeah. Well, it quotes this part, yeah, of the Anunatva Apunatva, explains it first, yeah, and then comes a commentary. Yeah. So we see again the different layers of the Gulama. We have original verses which are based on the sutras, and then we have some verses which were inserted later and which explain the sutras. And here it says, the non-conceptual nature of mind of ordinary persons, noble ones, and perfect Buddhas, since it is the general characteristic in the three states, characterized by faults, qualities, and the ultimate purity of qualities respectively, this true nature of mind is naturally present in the same way, without a difference at any time, just as the hollow space of an earthen, copper, and golden vessel. Now, this is quite interesting. We have here a full equation of the Dharmakaya of a Buddha with the Buddha nature in sentient beings. But what the Gulama does here is, it says, well, ordinary sentient being is similar, or the nature of an ordinary sentient being is the same as a Buddha, a fully enlightened Buddha, only with respect to the non-conceptual nature of mind. Yeah? So, which is, in other words, a quality which everybody has. Yeah? So the true nature of mind is empty of concepts, of thought. Yeah? So, this quality everybody has. So it is only with regard to this non-conceptual nature, you could also say emptiness, that a sentient being is the same as a fully enlightened Buddha. And the example makes it most clear. The hollow space in an earthen pot is not different from the hollow space of a golden pot. Yeah? So, in other words, the emptiness of a sentient being's mind and the emptiness of a Buddha is not really different. So this full equation of the Buddha nature with the Dharmakaya is here to some extent reduced, yeah, to the emptiness of sentient beings and the emptiness of Buddhas. Yeah. Let me give you just one more example to illustrate that. I'm afraid, you know, that our time is running away. Well, one of the main sutras the Gulama is based on is the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, the Dishin Shekpe Ningpo Do in Tibetan, the Sutra on Buddha Nature. And it gives 9 examples which illustrate that all sentient beings have already a Buddha in them, and but they don't know it. Most of the examples in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra imply this meaning, except well, the example of a future monarch, a poor widow is pregnant, and her son will be the future ruler of the world, yeah? But she doesn't know it, and she feels very sorry and well, laments, but she doesn't know that she is already on the safe side of life, because she is the mother of the future king. But still, you know, like when you look at this example, you could say, well, some growth is implied, because the future monarch still has to grow, it's only an embryo. And you could argue, well, something does not change at all, you know, the emptiness of our mind. But the qualities, the Buddha qualities, they still have to grow, yeah, just as the embryo has to grow. So you could well, justify such a distinction. But on the other hand, the other examples are pretty clear. Example number 5 goes as follows. Well, a man has buried a treasure under his house, and he died all of a sudden and could not tell his son that a treasure is buried under his house. And the son is poor and is starving, and he doesn't know that a lot of gold and silver and jewels are just 0.5 meter below him. Yeah. So this is an example, and in a similar way, all sentient beings suffer so much, and they don't know that they have this fantastic Buddha in them. Yeah. But the point here is that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra equates the treasure under the house with the 32 qualities of the Dhammakaya, which are the 10 strengths of the Buddha, different types of wisdom, so to say, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 particular features of a Buddha, special features, yeah, also different types of qualities. So, but when you say that this treasure stands for the 32 qualities of the Dhammakaya, you would fully equate the Buddha nature with the Dhammakaya of a Buddha. You would say, well, in this Buddha nature are already all qualities fully present. Yeah. Now, when you look again at the Gulama, it fully quotes the Tathagatagarbha Sutra and takes over all explanations of the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. But this one explanation that the treasure stands for the 32 qualities of the Dhammakaya is missing in the Gulama, which is quite interesting. And later on in the Gulama, we find an explanation that the kayas of the Buddha, yeah, the Dhammakaya or the Svabhavika Kaya, which are still the same in these early texts, and the form kayas, the Svabhavika Kaya and the Nirmana Kaya, they arise from 2 types of potentials. One is the naturally present potential, which everybody has. Yeah. And from this naturally present potential, yeah, the Svabhavika Kaya or the Dhammakaya of the Buddha arises. So because you have this naturally present potential, you will have a Dhammakaya when you become a Buddha, or a Svabhavika Kaya when you become a Buddha. This is what the Gulama here says. Yeah. And it illustrates this process by example number 5 from the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. Yeah. So this is quite interesting, because in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, the cause already has the 32 qualities, but in the Gulama, it is only the fruit which has the 32 qualities. And this is not just by chance, you know. So I think this was done by intention. Yeah. So why did the author of the Gulama not say that the treasure under the house is the 32 qualities of Dharmakaya, because he is using this example to show that the Dharmakaya arises or grows from the naturally present potential. Now, just to complete this, there is another potential, which is the fortified potential, which you acquire by studying the Dharma, practicing, and so on. Yeah. And from this fortified potential, you will have the form kayas of a Buddha when you become a Buddha. Yeah. So, to sum up, in my opinion, the author of the Gulama interpreted the old sutras which teach a Buddha nature, but at the same time, the author was aware of the philosophical problematic passages in these sutras and explained them away or interpreted it in a way that it became acceptable in mainstream Buddhism. And in my opinion, the author brought it in line with Yogacara philosophy. Yeah. He brought it in line with the other Maitreya works. Yeah. For example, the Uta Namche or the Chöni Namche. And this becomes clear when we understand that Buddha nature is defined in the Gulama as suchness accompanied by stains. Samala tatata. And Dharmakaya is the stainless suchness, tatata, which is characterized by fundamental transformation, ne yongsu churpa or ashaya parivritti. So this term is normally found in Yogacara philosophy, and the way Buddha nature and Dharmakaya is explained in this part of the Gulama is very similar to the Chöni Namche, the Dhammadhammata Vibhaga, where the transformation of the basis is, or the fundamental transformation is explained in a similar way. Yeah? And the Dhammata in the Dhammadhammata Vibhaga is also explained to be luminous by nature, and it is compared to the pure nature of space, to the pure nature of the gold element and the water element, and this pure nature manifests when the adventitious stains are removed, which is a picture very similar to what you find also in the Gulama. And you find something similar also in the Uta Namche, in the Madhyanda Vibhaga, in another Maitreya work, which is quite interesting because it does not fit properly with the original Yogacara philosophy of the three natures, the dependent, the imagined, and the perfect nature. And when you look at the first part of the first chapter of the Uta Namche, you find an explanation of the three natures on the basis of the dependent nature, which is explained as false imagining, and this dependent nature is a basis for the manifestation of the object-subject duality of the imagined, but its true nature is the emptiness from this duality. So the perfect is the dependent empty of the imagined. But when you look at the second part of the Uta Namche in the first chapter, all of a sudden it is not the dependent nature anymore in the center of the explanation of the three nature philosophy, but it is an emptiness which is positively understood, which is equated with suchness, which is equated with luminosity. And it is said that this emptiness can be pure and impure. Yeah? And it is explained in the Uta Namche, it is pure because it is luminous. It has natural luminosity. And it is not pure because it can be covered by adventitious stains. And it is clear that the dependent nature, which is false imagining, which was before in the center of the model of three natures, has moved now to the border of the model, and it is now included in the adventitious stains. So the well, emptiness, which is at the same time also luminosity and suchness, is empty of the adventitious defilements, which is of course then also the imagined and dependent nature. So, well, you could say that there is an influence, yeah, of Tathagatagarbha theory, or there is an influence of the Gulama in the Uttanamche. So we have a mutual influence here. Yeah. On the one hand, we see that all concepts on Buddha nature in the sutras are brought into the mainstream by bringing them into line with Yogacara philosophy. On the other hand, we find an influence of the Gulama in some other Yogacara works of the Maitreya works. And, well, after all, maybe it's not so wrong to say that there was an author of all the Maitreya works, you know. It could be that there was simply one person who just summarized the different sutras, yeah, Prajnaparamita sutras, which would be then the Abhisamayalankara, the Nöntokyen, who summarized all the Yogacara philosophy, which would be the Uttanamche, Chuninamche, and the Dodikyen, yeah, the three Yogacara works, and who summarized the sutras which teach a Buddha nature, which would be then the Gulama. And well, this one author somehow tried to bring these different groups of sutra together, and he somehow tried to harmonize the doctrine. So that's my provisional analysis of what happened there. So that's about the Gulama itself. And now we come to the next part. I don't know how much time we have left. It's 3 o'clock already. Can we continue? Or? Yeah, the Mahamudra interpretation of the Maitreya works or the Gulama, which is Gulotsava's main intention, and which is explained in detail in my book, A Direct Path to the Buddha Within. And now I told you already that Mahamudra is normally a tantric concept. Well, it is, well, of course, the fruit of the tantric path, but it can refer also to a particular practice, which is sometimes described as Amanasikara or Yila Michepa, which means to become mentally disengaged, not to withdraw one's attention from something. Well, a concept which was very, very controversial. It was attributed to the Chinese position in the Samye debate. Proponent of Chinese Buddhism was accused of teaching Amanasikara, or the teaching of not becoming mentally engaged. That would be enough, just to refrain from mental engagement. But you find this term in the Mahamudra literature, and in the Dohas, in the Mahamudra Upadesha by Saraha also. Mahamudra practice is described as Yila Michepa, as not becoming mentally engaged. But it involves also a direct experience of the true nature. It's not simply not becoming engaged in the dualistic process of false imagining, but at the same time you have to realize the true nature of mind. And this direct introduction into the true nature of mind is made possible by special instructions from your Lama, and by the blessing of the Lama, so to say, and just by connecting with a Lama, so an enlightened Lama can introduce you or connect you with his enlightened experience, and so you can have a direct introduction. So the practice of not becoming mentally engaged must be combined with its direct experience of the true nature of mind. So by whatever means you gain this direct experience. Yeah. It must be combined with this Mahamudra path. Now, the point is that usually you gain a direct experience of the true nature of mind by tantric means. But you find in some Mahamudra texts, also Mahamudra explanations outside of the strict tantric context. And it is interesting that it is linked with Dharani, the Nirvikalpa Pravesha Dharani, which is non-tantric. It is a Dharani is a short sutra taught by the Buddha also, and this Dharani is on how one realizes the non-conceptual. And now in this teaching by ascribed to the Buddha, you abandon wrong concepts, wrong characteristic signs, like the wrong characteristic signs of dualistic appearances, and then the wrong characteristic signs of the remedy. When you apply a remedy, you may get attached to the remedy and cling to it, and then you have a wrong appearance of this remedy. This also must be abandoned, and in doing so, you think about the emptiness of this remedy, but then you may have a wrong understanding of emptiness and cling to some wrong concept of emptiness, and then you have to remove this also by not becoming mentally engaged. And finally, when you're on the path, you have first experience of realization, or glimpses of your true nature, and then you might cling to that and have wrong concepts on that, and this also must be abandoned. Now, this abandoning of the four sets of characteristic signs is explained also in the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga. And what Gulotsava does is, when he explains this passage in the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga, well, if you want to understand in which way this is abandoned, you have to look in the Dharani, in the Nirvikalpa Pravesha Dharani, where it is said that this is abandoned by not becoming mentally engaged. Then you have a text by Maitripa, which is an exposition on empowerment, Sikanya Disha. And this is a text which explains the four seals. It would go too far now to explain the four seals, but there is an explanation also of Mahamudra, the great seal. And it is said that he who is not attached to a remedy and has not a wrong concept on emptiness, and who does not desire the fruit, he finds Mahamudra. And this verse is then explained on the basis of the Nirvikalpa Pravesha Dharani. Yeah. So we have a connection, from the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga via the Nirvikalpa Pravesha Dharani to the Sikanya Disha, and can connect a main point of the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga with Mahamudra this way, by the bridge of this practice of not becoming mentally engaged. And now Gulotsava says, the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga is a commentary on the second chapter of the Vilama, which is on enlightenment. So if you can read Mahamudra into the Dhamma Dhammatavibhaga, you can read it also into the Vilama. This way he justifies Mahamudra teachings on the basis of the Maitreya works. And he explains Buddha nature mainly as the natural mind, the uncontrived mind, which is naturally present, which does not need to be created, which has always been there. It's just this natural mind, uncontrived, and it is not tainted by all the defilements. So whatever you do, in whatever difficult situation you are, you always have this well, natural, uncontrived mind in you, and you always have the option, to ignore the suffering or the disturbing emotions, the afflictions, and to just look into the true nature of the affliction, and to just relax into this original, uncontrived mind. So, and this you can do with the help of special instructions, and you're advised to do that in whatever situation you are. Even if you experience very strong suffering, it is possible to just look into the true nature of this suffering and experience the natural, uncontrived mind or nature of this suffering. So at any moment, you have two sets or two possible experiences. One is your direct realization of the true nature of mind or your Buddha nature. And at the same time, there's also this whole process of dependent arising, of the defilements and afflictions going on, which is your just ordinary life or your experience in samsara. And how do these two relate to each other? It is like Buddha nature and the adventitious stains. It is said, Buddha nature in the Gulama is not empty of the Buddha qualities, which are inseparable, but it is empty of the adventitious stains, which are separable. You have two sets of qualities. One set of qualities which is always to some extent present, and always there, naturally there, without any causes and conditions. And there are other factors of existence, the afflictions, which are separable. And Gulotsava compares this to the heat of water and the heat of fire. The heat of fire is always there. Wherever you have a fire, there's also heat. A fire without heat is not possible. So in this sense, the quality of heat is inseparable from fire. But the heat of water is a quality which can be separated. You just have to put the hot water in the cold and let it cool down, and it will lose this quality of being hot. So in this sense, there is nothing to be added and nothing to be removed to this true nature of mind. It is already there. All these qualities of a Buddha are already there, connected to your true nature of mind. And all the rest, the adventitious stains, the suffering and so on, does not really have to be removed from it, because it does not really belong to it. It is just adventitious. It's just covering it from outside. So you just have to cool down, and this disturbing emotions will just disappear by themselves. They have never been there in this true nature. In this way, he connects the Gulama teaching with Mahamudra teachings. And you can have this direct experience of your true nature of mind on the Mahamudra path with the help of special instructions. And by this you have this direct access. And you can just let the adventitious stains disappear or dissolve on their own. It's quite interesting that Gulotsava distinguishes here different sets of Buddha qualities. One said, you have this distinction, of course, also in the Gulama, but he says it is only the qualities of the Dhammakaya, like the wisdom of the Buddha, the fearlessness, which is present, naturally present in the mind stream. The qualities of the body, like marks, the 32 major marks and 80 secondary signs of a Buddha, which mainly describe the appearance of his body. These are qualities of the form kayas, the Sambhoga and the Nirmanakaya. They are created, according to Gulotsava. They are not naturally present. You have to acquire them by accumulation of merit. But the qualities of the Dharmakaya, they are present, but he says only in a very subtle way. And which means, well, you have subtle Dharmakaya qualities which naturally grow in their own sphere. So you don't need any outer causes and conditions for them to grow. But as you just remove the stains, the adventitious stains, these seeds of qualities, he calls them seeds also, just grow naturally. And he is using this example of the embryo of the future monarch in the womb of the destitute woman. So the seeds are already there, but they just have to naturally grow. And well, it's quite interesting. I found in the commentary by Gulotsava a nice explanation of what these subtle qualities are. Gulotsava at some point says that well, everything is without beginning. Like even a rice seed or everything has no beginning, you know, like there always have been causes and conditions of this particular stream of events of rice seed. Well, he quotes Aryadeva, the 400 verses of Aryadeva to make this point. And when you look at Aryadeva's text, it truly says that everything is without a beginning. And then Gulotsava argues, well, but then where is this rice corn then after a world has been destroyed and before the new world has been formed? Yeah? So in Pralaya, so to say. So if everything is without a beginning, so where are these things then after the world, the old world has been terminated? And he says, well, but they continue in a subtle form. Yeah? And you find a similar concept also in the Kalachakra Tantra, where you have some subtle space-like imprints, you know, of the elements which remain in the state between two universes, and which are the cause for the future gross elements in the new world. So you have some kind of subtle space-like qualities, and he says when the new world forms these subtle space-like qualities, they are the cause then for the gross elements again. And he says, well, the 32 qualities of the Dharmakaya in the mind stream of sentient beings is like these subtle elements or these subtle qualities during two worlds. So in other words, it comes down to saying we have only seeds of Buddha qualities, but they don't depend on external conditions and causes. They will just naturally grow when the obstructing defilements are removed. So that's quite interesting. I mean, there's much more to say about Gulotsava's interpretation, but this is one of the main things. You know, I mean, he is distinguishing also two types of emptiness, which I should maybe know. Well, he says the emptiness of the non-affirming negation as taught by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, or mainly as taught as by Chandrakirti in the Madhyamaka Avatara, this is an average emptiness. But well, the emptiness of the third Dhamma Chakra, which is Rik Tong, which is awareness and emptiness, as taught in the third Dhamma Chakra and explained by Maitripa, is supreme emptiness. So he distinguishes also two types of emptiness, but he doesn't say Shen Tong, he doesn't say Rang Tong Shen Tong, he doesn't follow this concept. So if he is a Shentongpa or not, it's difficult to say. I mean, he doesn't use the word Shentong. But he says that, well, this natural mind, Tamel Gishepa, which has its seeds of the Buddha qualities, is just not dependent on other causes and conditions and is not fabricated. So, which would be the condition for saying something has a svabhava or exists, truly is there. And then he says, well, this natural mind is not impaired by all the adventitious stains. It's empty of like all the kleshas, all the dualistic appearances, all the concepts and theories and so on. Yeah? There's a long list, you know, of dualistic appearances and whatever belongs to this category. And he says, well, this natural mind is empty of all that, which does not belong to it. So it would be a mere play of word to call this Shentong. I mean, but he himself does not use this term. Yeah. It's also quite interesting that Gulotsava follows the equation of the Alaya Vijnana, the basic consciousness, with Buddha nature. Yeah. In the Yogacara, for example, you have a very strict distinction between the impure mind and the pure mind. Yeah. For example, in the Mahayana Sangraha, it is explained that when you practice and do virtuous deeds in the Dharma, these seeds are not put in the Alaya Vijnana, because this is the storehouse only of the impure samsara. But Dharmakaya, or the mind of the Buddha, pervades all mind streams, and also your mind stream. And when you study the Dharma and practice, the imprints of these deeds are stored in this part of the Buddha mind, which pervades your mind. So there's a very strict distinction between the impure mind of the Alaya Vijnana and the pure mind. Yeah. So you would say that, in this Yogacara work, the term Buddha nature is not mentioned, but if you have such a strict distinction between pure and impure, you would say that Buddha nature and the Alaya Vijnana would be something completely different. You know. But in the Langavatara, it is said that the Alaya Vijnana and the Buddha nature are exactly the same. They are equated. So it is illustrated, for example, by Gulotsava uses example of the waves and the ocean. So the waves are not really different from the ocean. It's the same thing. So, in other words, this Buddha nature becomes the Alaya Vijnana. Yeah. Well, if it has some disturbing emotions or all the adventitious stains. Yeah. So it is like when the ocean is steered up by the wind, it manifests waves. So the Buddha nature can manifest suffering and all that. Yeah. But these qualities are separable. The Buddha nature can be separated from these qualities. But still, the moment it has these qualities, you're really experiencing suffering. So, I mean, even though the heat of water is a separable quality, you burn your hand when you put it into hot water. So in the same way, these disturbing emotions really harm you, even though they are separable. So in this sense, there is a difference between Gulotsava's interpretation and the Shentong. Because the Shentong class, they follow this clear-cut distinction between the pure and the impure. Yeah. You find that, for example, in the works of the third Karmapa, Rangchung Dorjen, who follows the Mahayana Sangraha, this example I just explained to you. And, Gulotsava also, I wanted to say Dolpopa. Dolpopa also says that, the Buddha nature is something entirely different from the adventitious stains. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for him, the Buddha nature is ultimate truth. Yeah. And the Chodangpas mainly follow the original intention of the sutras on Buddha nature. And they don't follow this, they don't see this attempt by the author of the Gulama to bring the teaching of the Tathagatagarbha Sutras into mainstream Buddhism. They don't accept that. They just follow the original intention of the Tathagatagarbha or the Srimaladevi or the Anunatva or Punatva, and insist that this is the original intention of the Gulama. So they interpret it in a different way. Yeah. In my opinion, against the intention of the author of the Gulama, but this is what they do. Yeah. So in this sense, there is a difference between Gyulotsava's interpretation and the Shentong of the Chunang Pass. I mean, I could now say much more, you know. I mean, Buddha nature was a very interesting topic in Tibet, and there are many different interpretations. I've never seen a topic in Tibetan Buddhism on which there were so many different ideas and concepts. So you have to continue talking. But I was told we should limit it to 1 hour, and we have extended 1 hour now. And I think you have some questions also, probably. Yeah.
About the continuum, what is the approach or the image to explain how it can be functional if it's characterized by never changing, not fabricated, no beginning, black space, and so on? How can it be how could it be causal, or how could it have some role in life?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are different approaches, yeah? I mean, the one is the one of the Chodong Pass, and they say, well, it is just permanent in the sense that it doesn't belong to the three times and to space. It's just completely transcendent and outside of this world. That's one explanation, yeah, which I did not explain yet. Yeah? Well, I explained the continuum of the Buddha nature or the nature of mind. Well, here in this world, which is the explanation of Gyulotsava, and which, well, I think is also the intention of the author of the Gyulama. And, they admit a change. Yeah? They don't say it is completely permanent. I mean, that's why they try to establish a difference between the Buddha nature of a sentient being and the Dharmakaya, because they want to show that something evolves, something grows. Yeah? And, Gyulotsava says, well, you have in nature, for example, take space. Yeah? It is not fabricated, and it does not depend on any causes and conditions. Yeah? But still, it continues. And it undergoes change also. Like, for example, when a world has formed, there is less space in space than before it has been formed. So before a universe developed, there was more space in space than afterwards. So there is some kind of change in space. So he doesn't say it is impermanent, but he somehow doesn't like the notion of real permanence either. So he wants to explain that there is a continuity. And there is, in other words, a possibility of a continuity, yeah, of something which does not depend on causes and conditions. For example, space. And he says, well, the true nature of mind is like that. It will continue forever, and it does not depend on causes and conditions for it to continue. So it will simply continue, just as space continues. So this is the idea. I don't know whether this is reasonable or not, but I mean, you could argue that space also, like in modern physics, space depends on materia, yeah? And in Tibet, obviously, they did not have this insight, yeah, which physicists have. Or that the Big Bang produces also space. But this is not what Tibetans or Indians thought, yeah? So anyway, it is only an example, yeah? So we have to take it as an example, not as a proof. Yeah, you are next.
Could you give some advice from studying the Buddha Tantra? Or maybe it would be better to say to practice the Buddha Tantra in either a chela or a tree. And if you could say something about either memorization or contemplation.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, of course, good to memorize texts. We had to do that when I studied at the Mapa Institute. And, I had to memorize the Chuni Namche, and it really helps also to learn the Tibetan language or even Sanskrit, you know, if you memorize it in Sanskrit. But I think it's, of course, also important to understand or grasp the meaning, because we don't have the time, the same time as young monks have. I mean, we cannot spend 10 years of our life memorizing all the sutras and shastras and then eventually get explanations on them. So I think it's better to just study a text directly and try to understand it as you read it and seek clarification on it. And I mean, it would be good, you know, to read it together with a Tibetan commentary. Yeah. A very good commentary is by Mipham Rinpoche, for example. You could use, But I mean, you have to be aware that the Nyingmapas, again, you know, they use the concept of Buddha nature in a particular way. Yeah. I mean, they link it up to some extent with the concept of Rigpa. And I found that in the works of Longchen Rabchampa, for example. So, the noble kata would the, in essence, it is primordially pure. This would just refer to the natural purity of the Buddha nature, or the luminosity, if you want, also natural luminosity. And Rangshin Lundrop, the nature of spontaneous presence, refers to the qualities, the Buddha qualities, so they are spontaneously present. Well, then Tukche is self-evident, because it's a quality, a Buddha quality, to have compassion. So it's a nice interpretation of the Gyulama, and at the same time, the Gyulama gives doctrinal support for Dzogchen teachings also. Well, I found that when I studied the Drum Ta Tse of Longchen Rabchampa, first you have the presentations of the lower tenets, like Yogacara and so on, and general Mahayana. And whenever you had a concept on the ultimate, like perfect nature or Buddha nature or whatever, it was somehow brought in relation with Rigpa, with primordial awareness, or I don't know which translation you prefer. And then later on, so they show already, or Longchen Rabchampa showed, that here we have already the concept of Rigpa, even in the Shastras and Sutras. And later on, in the presentation of Dzogchen, just after an explanation that the Sutra system is inferior because there is still dualistic clinging and so on, and then he continues explaining some aspect of Rigpa, and he quotes the Gyulama, which is interesting. First he criticizes the sutra system, and just two lines further down he quotes the Gyulama. So you see how important the Gyulama is, you know. For, it provides doctrinal support for the Dzogchen teaching. So it's okay. I mean, you must be aware of these differences here. But it's still better, I advise, to study the Gyulama together with a Tibetan commentary. I mean, the ideas Gyulotsava forwards are also compatible with Dzogchen. I mean, so if you want to have a very detailed commentary, you could read the Gyulama commentary by Gyulotsava, but it takes a long time then. Otherwise, I would suggest to study the Mipham commentary.
About the authorship, is it thought that it was spread over a long period of time, the authorship of the Tarakanta Shastra, like 100 years or several hundred years?
Well, there are some elements in the Gyulama which are pretty old, and I don't think they are by the same author. I mean, the original building blocks of the Gyulama.
That's the core verses.
There are some. Well, Schmidhausen comes to an original Gyulama of only 15 verses, and but then he says, well, you can't call that original Gyulama anymore. So it's just one of the many building blocks of the text, and but you have to consider that. Scholars, Indian scholars, and later also Tibetan scholars, they memorized many teachings, and so they had this thread of shlokas, yeah, in their memory. And when they were composing something, of course, you know, they were influenced, or they remembered, you know, certain groups of verses they had memorized before. So it looks like they have copied it. Well, if the Gulama had been written in the 21st century, I would say, well, somebody has first written a text of 15 verses on the computer, and then he found, oh, this needs a little bit more explanation, and then he inserted a few more verses, you know, like we write something, you know, on the computer, isn't it? Like we start to write something, and then we find, oh, but here we need something else, oh, this fits better in this part. And so it looks a little bit like that, you know. But I think, you know, like scholars have memorized a lot, and so sometimes when they write something, it was influenced, and for them it was not so bad to copy something, you know. I mean, they didn't have this concept of plagiarism. Once you have memorized something, it belonged to you, you know, you can use it. There was nothing wrong, you know, with just using a few words. I mean, you find a verse from the Bhagavad Gita in the Gulama.
Good.
Yeah, really. 152. Well, it's just one verse, you know. It's just one tiny word is different from the Bhagavad Gita.
What century was that core of verses?
I think 4th, 5th century after Christ. Yeah?
When it is... But there's all these references to beginningless time or infinite amounts of time.
Mm.
Would you interpret that as an actual infinity, kind of in a mathematical sense, or as a way of saying extremely large, beyond the mind, beyond what you can grasp?
Probably in a mathematical sense, because you cannot admit a beginning.
Mm.
Because then what was before the beginning? So what was the cause of the beginning? But it, yeah, beginninglessness is also a problem to some extent. Once the Dalai Lama was asked this question at the University of Bonn, and well, he said, well, there is some problem in saying that the world is beginningless, but we have less problems than saying it has a beginning.
That's what I meant with the second alternative, saying if it really means without beginning, or if it means kind of beyond the difference of beginning and no beginning.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, the Chonanpas definitely go in this direction. Yeah, they say that the ultimate is beyond space and time. And you find it also in the works of Rangchung Dorje. So he says time and beginning and end is only a concept, and true nature is empty of this concept. So it would go a little bit in this direction, yeah. But I agree, you know, like it's difficult to say. The texts themselves, they don't say more than what I told you. So maybe we have to add our own understanding to that. Or if somebody has a better explanation of it. Well, Big Bang is also quite interesting, you know, because everything is created by Big Bang. Even time is created, you know. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? That's what they say.
I think so.
But then there would be, well, then the beginning wouldn't make sense then, yeah. If it constitutes the origination of time. Well, difficult to say. I think as long as you are in samsara, and then you have this notion of a continuity of time and space, and from this perspective, you would say there's no beginning, or it's limitless.
Mm.
But then when you go beyond space and time, well, it doesn't make sense anymore to talk about time, isn't it? I'm sorry, I don't have more to offer. Yeah?
I have a question on a slightly different level. I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit about, if you had any, of course, challenges in the translation, you know, from the Tibetan that you encountered. Some of us are learning to translate, learning Tibetan.
Mm-hmm.
I think your experience with that would be very useful.
Yeah, one has to distinguish two kinds of Tibetan. One is the translation literature, like direct translations from the Sanskrit. And, well, then you have the texts which were written directly in Tibetan. And, well, one has to use two different sets of glasses, you know, when you read these two types of literature. The thing is that the Tibetan translators translated very mechanically. They follow the Sanskrit syntax, and whenever there was a prefix, they translated. You know, they used a Tibetan word for the prefix, and even the grammatical cases are just rendered one to one. But sometimes, in the Sanskrit, a genitive implies a different meaning than in Tibetan. So you have to be aware of these things when you read translated texts from Indian material. And also the prefixes, you have sam anu pashyati. So the verb is pashyati, he sees. Yeah? And anu is just intensifying, which means very profound seeing or intensive seeing. And sam means just all inclusive, so everything. So sam anu pashyati would be something like, fully realizes or fully sees or truly sees or something. Yeah? And then the Tibetans, they just have translated the sam with yang dak par. Yeah? And anu, they have translated by chisu, yeah? Which also can mean later. And then tong, yeah? Yang dak par, chisu tong. So I have seen translations like, as it is in reality, you will see later. I mean, which is logical, you know. When you just look at the Tibetan, you could arrive at such an understanding and translate accordingly. But you see what can happen, you know. So if you have the time to study a little bit of Sanskrit, I mean, it really helps a lot, you know, when you translate texts like Vyayama. I mean, you have fortunately all the commentaries, and before a lot of Tibetan scholars, they knew Sanskrit, and there was also an oral tradition, so the Tibetan commentaries have it more or less right. So if you don't understand the root text, just look at the Tibetan commentary and follow the commentary, and then you are pretty safe. Yeah. But if you want to understand why to translate the root text in such a way, you have to look into the Sanskrit. So if you have the time to study a little bit of Sanskrit, it would be very helpful. But don't employ a Hindu scholar, because they don't know Buddhist Sanskrit texts. And you would, waste your time studying a Sanskrit which is not very helpful. So if you start that, just directly study, for example, Ratnakotra Vibhaka or Madhyanda Vibhaka or Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, yeah. And just find somebody who can understand Sanskrit of the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas. I wouldn't start reading Hindu texts or Kavya literature or something. So it would be a waste of time. I mean, if you have the time, it's nice, of course.
You told us that you were a scientist at the beginning?
Not really. I just studied a few semesters of physics and mathematics. Yeah.
I was wondering if you ever came back to the question you had in quantum physics with the light, in the light of the Buddhist teachings.
Yeah, it's something which interests me a lot. And I mean, what I find very interesting is the influence of the observer on the observed. And there was a discussion in physics going on whether there is some influence, such an influence. But all depends a little bit on interpretation. And the majority of physicists they somehow think they can explain quantum physics without the role of the observer. So a dialogue is very difficult at this point. But there are a few who are open to that. But like, I would warn you to just invite a normal physicist and discuss with him. And might be a little bit... Well, they are doing that in Dharamsala, yeah? These mind and life conferences, which is quite interesting. But you soon come to a point where well, you can't continue somehow. I mean, you could say Madhyamaka philosophy or Yogacara philosophy could provide a philosophical framework for what you discover in quantum physics. So it's up to the physicists if they want to accept this framework or not. So, I mean, if you accept it, yeah, it leads to a very interesting model. But I think, yeah, such a dialogue should be continued or started. It would be very fruitful, I think. But it's difficult for both sides, because established physicists, it's also dangerous. You have to have a dialogue with Buddhist philosophers. Maybe we should find retired physicists to end the dialogue. They don't have to be careful anymore. I mean, for a Tibetologist, it's not really dangerous. I'm not afraid of it. We invited last summer in Hamburg a physicist, and we had a talk there. It was, I just explained emptiness and dependent arising on the basis of Nagarjuna, and he presented like his discoverings of quantum physics. And then there was a discussion, and it was quite interesting. But he simply did not admit that the observer has a role to play. He says, well, I know there has been a lot of discussion on that, but I can explain it without the observer. So then what? You know, that was the end of the discussion. Still, it was very interesting.
We'll have one last question. Was there a controversy from the beginning of the Gurulama's history, the Gautama Shastra's history, about this idea of a great self or Buddha nature, and how it resembled non-Buddhist ideas of a great Atman or something like that? Was that from the beginning like a source of debate and tension and so forth?
I think so, yeah. It is also remarkable that the Gulama over five centuries was not quoted at all anymore. And that was just in the time when Buddhist philosophy was attacked by non-Buddhist philosophers. And that was the time when people like Dignaga and Dhammakirti defended Yogacara philosophy and had to define what valid cognition is in Buddhist terms, and they had you can see that in early Yogacara or in the Gulama, the doctrine is formulated in a way that it can be easily understood. It's very nice to read these texts. But later on, you know, after Dhammakirti, Buddhist philosophical texts become really difficult to understand, and you can sense the pressure the Buddhist philosophers experienced, you know, and they were very careful what they wrote then, and just defined it in a way that it can survive debate. And in this period, the Gulama was not quoted at all. Yeah, you don't find it, for example, in the big commentary on the Abhisamayalankara, which quotes so many other Buddhist texts, and it's simply missing for five centuries. And if we did not have the early Chinese translation of the Gulama, we would have no proof that it was already written in the 5th century. So this shows that, these concepts were a little bit problematic. Yeah. And I mean, I have not studied Shankaracharya, but I know it from discussions that the non-Buddhist side, well, some Advaita Vedantins were very close to Buddhist philosophy, and well, they said, well, your doctrine is perfectly fine with us, except that you insist on this impermanence. Yeah. If you would give up this notion, you know, you would be perfect. So in such a context, it's of course difficult to have sutras which say that the Dharmakaya is the perfection of Atman. It's a perfect Atman. So if I mean, I remember there was in the life story of Chonan Kunga Drolchok, he met non-Buddhist yogis in Muktinath, and there was a discussion, and Chonan Kunga Drolchok was just explaining Shantong teaching, and the sadhu sage just said, well, welcome, you're one of us. But I didn't consult the Tibetan text myself, but Franz Karl Erhard has published this in one of his papers. But what I find interesting is that already the author of the final version of the Kingdom already tried to explain away this Atman theory. So he already was aware of the problems involved.
There is certain verses that address this directly.
Yeah, this passage from the Srimala Devi or from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. Yeah. Well, there are many others, you know. I just picked a few examples. Dedicate the merit, if there is any. Maybe can you dedicate the merit? Do you know the prayer?
Through this merit, may all beings attain the omniscient state of enlightenment and conquer the enemy of false illusion. May they all be liberated from the session of samsara and from its founding waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death.
I thank you very much.
Thank you.